Well, we're going to go to Athlone shortly to talk to the IMO's new president, Dr. Aina Kelly. But it's been another week in which the vaccine rollout had to adapt to new medical advice. First, the decision to give AstraZeneca to only those between 60 and 70. J&J pausing its one-shot vaccine for now. And then Pfizer coming into the rescue to make up the shortfall. What effect is this having on doctors and their patients? I spoke to Dr. Shane McHugh of Sullis Medical Centre in Rathfarnham.
The plan had been the week before last that we would be using AstraZeneca, but as everybody will have heard, that was stopped for a period of time. And AstraZeneca is now being used in the mass vaccine clinics, so not the GP surgeries.
And are you getting any queries from those that you are vaccinating about which vaccine they're getting? Are people anxious about AstraZeneca or anxious to know in your case that they're not getting it?
Yeah, to be honest, we haven't seen that. I mean, we did vaccinate 2 weeks ago and at that stage it wasn't an issue. So we'll know more in a few days. But I think that people always asked us, what vaccine am I getting? It's a natural question. They want to understand that. In my own experience to date, people would take any vaccine they were offered. And I think that's the right view, to be honest.
So in your practice, you're not taking calls from those in the 60 to 69 age group about concern over the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Our admin staff have been handling calls as quickly as they can. And what they've been advising people is if they're in the 60 to 69 category, they will be given the AstraZeneca vaccine through the mass vaccine clinics. We have certainly seen some calls coming through about this, but it hasn't been massive.
And what is your biggest issue now? What's the biggest issue for GPs?
I think GPs and their staff are very tired at this point. As, to be honest, most of the population are. It's been a really long year. We're very privileged and very happy to be doing this work for people in terms of vaccinating them. But we are tired and it's hard to balance that alongside the normal workload. Bear in mind, a lot of the normal work people would have been worried about for other medical illnesses, they put aside during the time COVID was surging in the community. And that's still coming at us. I think probably the hardest thing is the pressure we see on our staff. So it's just if people could bear with us in the community, and we will get through things as quickly as we can and as well as we can in time. So that's probably the hardest thing at the moment.
Indeed. But do you have replacements if you do need to take time off?
It's unclear, Carol, if I'm honest. Locum doctors will take a look potentially at the workload GPs and their staff are working on at the moment. And it's not, you know, it's a big ask to want to step into our shoes at the moment. But I think we're all hopeful. Everybody is dying for a break everywhere in the country. So hopefully over the next few months, we'll all get some of a break there.
GP Dr. Shane McHugh speaking to me there from the Helix, where he was helping out with the vaccination rollout there this weekend. Well, Dr. Aina Kelly joins us now from our Athlone studio. She's the new president of the IMO. She's a public health doctor and a fifth generation medic. Welcome to This Week.
Thanks very much, Carol.
Well, we heard there Minister Stephen Donnelly saying that idea he had floated to perhaps vaccinate young and more mobile people before others in a bid to slow down the spread of COVID now is a non-runner. But what about this idea of lengthening the space between giving dose one and two, say for Moderna or Pfizer? Does that make sense from a public health perspective?
Well, I suppose it depends on the evidence, really, and I suppose that's what NIAC will be looking at. It's looking at the effectiveness of the evidence, you know, the evidence showing the effectiveness of the vaccines in the different spacing, you know, choices and options. Obviously, when the initial studies are done, the vaccine spacing is decided for the study itself, and therefore it's an ongoing study really throughout all of the implementation of vaccines throughout the world, when various options or new options are tried, to look then at the efficacy in relation to that. So I think that it's really in Ireland, it's for NIAC to make these to look at this and to make the decisions, because they're a very expert group. They have been leading on all of our vaccination programs for many years. They give the advice on those. They're very expert in that, and they look at the data all of the time for these things.
So you're saying that outside of NIAC's advice, the doctors wouldn't have concerns maybe about spacing, leaving more vulnerable people without their second dose?
Well, I suppose really you obviously have to take into account the prevalence or the, you know, the new incidence of new cases in the community and so on, and that may influence them. But NIAC will be able to also give some advice on that as well. But actually, I suppose you have to make sure that the spacing is the best spacing for the protection of people, which takes into account both protecting them from getting the illness themselves and protecting from transmission and so forth and so on as well. So you take all of the information into account and make the best decision with that.
Now, we are in a different place to last summer when you say that doctors knew that opening up would lead to a second wave. What do public health doctors such as yourself see as the biggest threat this summer as we talk about opening up again?
Well, I suppose, you know, we've been very concerned about the new variants because we're very dependent on international control of COVID as well. And I suppose that's the area that can really, I suppose, jeopardise the quality of the protection we're getting from vaccines now. Because we definitely perceived the vaccines were helping in nursing homes massively. And, the data seems to be indicating that. And, that we've protected an awful lot of our most vulnerable so far. But, of course, new variants are the big risk for us, because this is what happens in every pandemic that you have, we might be trying to control COVID very well in our country, but we're depending on every other country to do it too.
Yeah. So are you dismayed then when you hear of all the various exceptions that are coming through to the mandatory hotel quarantine, such as elite athletes, also the talk about people who are fully vaccinated being allowed to come in?
Well, I suppose all of those decisions need to be made based on evidence again. And I understand that for many of those groups, there are alternative ways of risk assessing. And if there are alternative methods for making sure that groups or people are not going to spread something if they're unlucky enough to have been exposed to a new variant, for instance, but that there's another plan in place to make sure that they don't spread it. That's something I suppose that can be decided nationally on that, because I suppose this is all about balance all of the time, and it is trying to be trying to get the right balance to protect everybody, and I suppose there are circumstances in which you can advise differently. Unfortunately, risk assessment takes a lot of work, and I suppose this is one of the problems I suppose public health have found in the last year. If there were more of us, we could do more bespoke risk assessments, and we haven't been able to do as much of that as we would have liked.
And let's talk about that. It's known as sort of the Cinderella of the medical service, and you, through your own lobbying on the Public Health Committee this week, you succeeded in making it a consultant-led medicine with 84 new consultant posts. But can I ask you, is that going to solve the problems that you've been talking about there, the lack of resources and support?
It's definitely a very, very good start. Now, we're putting proposals to ballot to our members at the moment, and we're recommending that they accept this. This is definitely a landmark decision insofar as the numbers and the fact that it is going to be an equal contract with others will make it as equally competitive with other branches of medicine. So we feel we'll be able to recruit much better, and we'll be able to retain people in the system an awful lot better, and so that we won't be losing people to other countries. Also, there's a new model of public health medicine that is going to, I suppose, really free up an awful lot of these expert doctors, the people who are specialists in public health medicine now, but will hopefully become consultants in public health medicine, that they will be able, with multidisciplinary teams working with them, will be able to spread their expertise much farther and be able to cover all of the the domains that we call our pillars of public health, which include things like health service improvement and health improvement, as well as what people are familiar with us now with health protection.
Now, you did say that the pandemic has laid bare the huge gaps in the health service. Horrific waiting lists for key and urgent procedures is what your predecessor, Padraig McGarry, said yesterday in his closing speech. As doctors return to non-COVID care, what are we going to see happening with these lists?
Well, I suppose big decisions are going to need to be made about funding, because there were very long lists before COVID came along, and which I suppose indicated that our system was very fragile in the first place and very under-resourced in many regards. So it's going to be very important that we decide that we are going to manage those waiting lists first. And if that's the case, then we're going to have to look at the resources required.
How do you manage them? What do you mean manage?
Well, you have to make a decision that you're going to actually get the waiting lists down to an acceptable level, which, should really be more like months rather than years, and at the most, I would say. And so to understand that, you're going to have to look at all of the gaps. What are the problems? Why are these lists in place?
The consultants.
Partly, that's one of the big parts of it. It is that the fact that there are huge vacancies at the moment in consultant posts at the moment. There are 700 vacant or just temporarily filled posts. And my understanding from my consultant colleagues is that this has really been going on since the 2012 unilateral decision to cut pay by 30%. And that was on top of other cuts that were happening at the time. So anybody who is newly appointed after that has really been not getting equal pay. And it's the worst decision in health policy for our lifetime, probably, because it has a corrosive effect. It really brings inequality into the workplace, a very serious inequality, where people aren't being paid equally for the equal work. And that means people don't want to work in those jobs.
And if it's going on that long, as you say, 2012, who or what is holding up negotiations on this, if it's that important to the health service?
I understand there hasn't been engagement on that to date. So I'm not, I understand the decision has not been made by government to actually deal with that yet.
So that's what you want?
I think that's essential. It's and it needs to be reversed as soon as possible, because I suppose when you have vacancies, that makes the workload harder for everybody else. Who, you know, apart from the public, I mean, the public are they suffering the most? They're the people, you know, the people who are suffering the long waiting lists. But not only that, though, the people who are providing the services that they can provide are trying to do that in horrendous conditions, because they're trying to provide more than they're actually able to do, so as to try and do what, you know, do what they can to over, you know, overcome some of the resource gaps. And that is just a stress that people aren't able to bear after a certain period of time. And it just makes everything just so hard, you know, to work in the health service when that's the case. And I suppose when we're looking at, you know, junior non-consultant hospital doctors, then they are working, you know, they're supposed to be working less than 48 hours average a week, but there's poor compliance with that throughout the country. I think only 25% compliance with that average, you know, the average maximum of 48 hours per week. And see, these are the doctors who are also working in the hospitals, okay, providing these services, you know, and some of, you know, there's a fair, you know, I think 30% or so who are working over 24-hour shifts as well. I mean, this isn't good for the doctors and it's not good for the patients.
Okay, so a lot to be sorted out and a lot of negotiations coming down the track during your tenure. Thank you very much, Dr. Aina Kelly, for joining us.